call this meeting to order. I apologize for my tardiness.
I apologize for mine too.
Okay. I'm going to open the public hearing on Senate Bill 407. First we have Kathy and Jerry Conklin. If there's groups, just have.
So what you're saying is my comment.
You're welcome.
Who cares?
End over here.
Hey. Chair Cruz, members of the committee, I'm Carolyn Graff, acting manager of the Transitional Resource Unit in the State Office for Services to Children and Families. I'm here to testify in support of Senate Bill 407, which proposes to make the names, address, and telephone numbers of our foster parents confidential to the people who care for the children in the state's custody. This bill is very important to us for two reasons. First of all, the safety of the children in our care. We first seek to work with the children and their parents in their own homes. When they are unable to safely remain in their homes due to physical or sexual abuse or due to extreme neglect, then the court orders them into our care and we place them in one of our foster homes. We want our foster parents to keep our children safe and help them recover from the trauma that brought them into our care. Second reason is for the safety of our foster families. 50% of our clients are criminally involved, and 65% of our clients are alcohol and drug involved. Our foster parents are not equipped or trained to deal with the unpredictability and the violence of some of our client population. So we are asking for the safety of our children and the safety of our foster families that this bill be supported. I've attached to my testimony comments from foster parents about their confidentiality, and there are foster parents here to testify, Kathy Conklin from Astoria and Richard McClay from Eugene. And I'd like you to hear their testimony.
I'm Kathy Conklin from Astoria, and I strongly believe that our personal stats should be kept confidential. I have had experience myself recently. I went to court on behalf of two little girls that are currently in my care. And I can't prove that it was the foster parents that did any of the things that have been done, but I can't prove that it wasn't. It hadn't happened prior to that. I get phone calls all hours of the day and night, hang up, nobody there. My car has been vandalized in the SDF parking lot. I have a 12-year-old in my care that came into care. He was not only neglected, he was abused. The parents were, the mother for sure, definitely into drugs very heavily, and has since, the woman was just totally maimed and thrown on a boat and burned 8 months ago, this child's mother. And I feel that the confidentiality of our names, addresses, and phone numbers are very important. I don't feel safe having those parents know where I'm at. So I really think this bill should be supported.
Questions? Representative Knoll.
How long have you been a foster parent?
I have been a foster parent for over 20 years.
Well, obviously this information hasn't been confidential before. Is it? Are you asking for it now because you're seeing an increase in actions taken by others, or are you just feeling more threatened because of violence in society? I'm trying to get at why it's needed now as opposed to 10 or 15 years ago.
Society is definitely more violent now, and the drug and alcohol, just from the children that we see, has increased immensely.
That's
really
wonderous.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Question, how would someone access the information now?
No, the information is disclosable under the public records law, and foster parents can only keep it confidential if they provide documentation of safety risk if that's divulged. Sometimes we don't know if parent might present a safety risk until we're a little more familiar with that case. And so the information might have already been divulged, and it shouldn't have been. We are concerned about the safety of our children in the beginning of these cases. Later on, the foster parents often work with the parents, have the parents in their home, but that's following a lot of services to the parents, like drug treatment and that kind of thing.
With the new acts that you will be actively involved with, and that's the termination of parental rights issue, where, as I understand it, the agency will be working a lot closer with the biological parents in an attempt to reconcile or to move them back home. And isn't the foster parent also involved and engaged in that activity?
Chair Cruz, Representative Winters, our foster parents are often involved with the biological parents when the children are ready to return home. Our foster parents participate in family unity meetings. They participate in visitation. But we pick and choose where, and the foster parents have input into when the parent will know their address. It's not without the foster parent agreeing to the plan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for coming over from Placer County. I just read an alarming statistic about our county that said we were second highest in the state for child abuse. So I appreciate the work that you do on behalf of children. Your testimony refers to your having given out your name in court. And I wonder, obviously, if you had that to do over again, and if you were somehow protected from doing that, that would be your choice to do so?
Absolutely.
And I know that the bill just calls for the agency to adopt rules, but you will address that part of it, the foster parent, when they're appearing in court on behalf of the child, could also be protected from giving out their name, disclosing their name. Do you think that's a possibility?
Representative Cruz, Chair Cruz, Representative Taylor, if I'm not sure I can answer that question.
Okay. Representative Lehman.
Sure. Ms. Compton maybe can answer this question. If we pass this bill, and making the information confidential, will that protect you if you go into court? Can a judge still ask you for your name and address, or an attorney ask for it, and you would still be required to give it?
I would think that should I request that it be written on paper and handed to the judge, that would be my next approach. I would really hope that I don't ever have to go in there and disclose my name again. That was a very frightening thing.
Yes, my name is Richard Mackley. I've been a foster parent with my wife for about 5 years. We're from Eugene. Her parents also were foster parents many years ago, and they had a couple instances where they had adopted her, one of the child in their care, and the parents, birth parents came after them down the road demanding the children back. They had to call the police. It was a very ugly situation and very scary, you know, for what had happened. And the kids we have in our care right now, we have one mother who is not the most stable person, and she has. We had to move last year because she knew our name, address, and phone number, and she called us all the time and bugged us and, you know, wanted to talk to us for no reason at all. And we just felt really uncomfortable having her calling us all the time. It's not, you know, we're not supposed to be her friend, basically. So we had to move, and we went to great lengths to make sure that information was kept confidential. She has tried to follow us home from visitations. And she's just not a stable person, and we really feel uncomfortable wanting her to have that information of where we live and our phone number and address. Because we, you know, hopefully would like to adopt those kids, and I don't want to have a situation where, you know, 2 years down the road, she goes knocking our door with a gun, where's my kids? Like happened to my wife, you know, when she was younger. And it's just, society's gotten so crazy nowadays, you don't know what people are going to do anymore. And I think it's important that, you know, for us and other foster parents out there, you know, we've gone to the steps to keep our information private now, but we didn't know about it until after it was too late. And it was, you know, other foster parents need to know that that's out there. They need to, shouldn't have to worry about that. This is a volunteer position we're doing. You know, we shouldn't have to be put in that risk situation. I think it's very important that we're, you know, protected. Because if not, no one's going to be foster care anymore. Then what happens to all the kids? And I got a big problem there.
Attorney Claus.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I commend foster parents for what they do. It's a tremendous burden to do it, and they provide a real service for our society. And I understand where you would want to be confidential because of the reasons you stated. However, I also have a concern for parents who have their children taken and then don't know where they are. And as a parent, I can understand how frightening that would be to them. So I want to be sure and weigh their rights, know where their children are as well. Maybe you could respond to
that. The kids that we have in our care, we have one other child that we have given the father our name and our phone number, and he's called and talked to us because we gave it to him. He was a real nice guy. He's made a lot of progress, and we felt comfortable giving it to him. We offered to be a support for him if the child goes back to him in his care, down the road for babysitting, whatever. But it's something we should be able to make that choice. And it depends on the situation. It's a lot of times. It shouldn't be a blanket policy that everyone's names are released. It should be depending on the situation of who gets that information and when they get it. And so it really depends on the situation of who gets it and when. But, you know, we are more than happy to help out the birth parents, you know, and talk to them and be a resource for them. If they're making progress, then we feel that they're a stable, safe, you know, situation to do that in.
Senator Winters.
Thank you. Carolyn, the Foster Parents Association, that listing comes through the agency, doesn't sometimes identification of the individuals who are part of that association. I just want to be sure that they're not cut off from their activity as well, and that the agency in crafting the administrative rules somehow allow to have association access.
Okay, Chair Cruz, Representative Winters, are you asking if foster parent associations would have access to our foster parent address and phone numbers? We'll make rules so that our foster parents associations continue to function and support the foster parents in the work that they do.
I know it's a viable organization. I really incorporate closely with the agency.
Any other questions? Thank you very much. Linda Terrell and Debbie Moffitt. Welcome.
Representative Cruz, I am Debbie Moffitt from Albany, and I have written you. I think by email, I have a copy of that letter and a letter I've written to our branch manager over a year ago. I don't have copies of those available. I'm sorry, I didn't realize they said. Would you like to hear the letter I wrote you again? Or
to the committee, yeah.
Okay. Dear Representative, we are foster parents in Linn County. We as such, we strongly urge you to support this bill, providing some privacy and protection to foster parents from having birth families know the whereabouts of our home and homes and their children. As difficult as our job can be, this is one area that you could easily help encourage us. We aim to help and even save lives, and only ask that you facilitate this one aspect of help. We have personally talked with our branch manager of SBF and have been alarmed to learn of the openness of these records. We trust and pray you make right decisions in this and other matters pertaining to our families. Thank you for your time. Over a year ago, before I heard of Senate Bill 407 or any advocation for it, I personally dealt with issues such as this and wrote a letter to the branch manager, which I must say I regret was not sent because of issues I dealt with in my home at the time. I delayed sending the letter and decided it wasn't that big of an issue, and I talked to him personally later, many months later, about it. I'd like to read that to you, too, if I may. This letter is to bring to your attention a matter that affects many foster families. It seems to be a caseworker's decision as to whether foster parents are to be known by name except to the birth parents. I was under the impression that we are caring for the children to protect them from their birth families, and all identifying information was to be confidential. In particular, I refer to caseworkers using my first and last name, invoice, and letters addressed to or in the presence of birth parents. I have personally approached workers previously and recently regarding this, yet it has continued. I think workers do not realize the impact of this. Also, in reference to this subject, HSAs, which deliver children transporting, are letting birth parents know where foster parents and the children live or go to school. When I've addressed this to the worker, I was told that they consider whether the case is high risk or not. In other words, unless a parent threatens a child or a family, they don't consider it a high risk. I like the approach that Citizens Review Board has is more appropriate. They identify the foster parent only as a substitute care provider. It seems much safer as a general rule, and any other relationship should not be expected of foster parents. If it seems in the best interest to child and foster families and birth families both, they could agree to further than both agree further and be open to that, to the acceptance of communicating together, as has previously been testified. Birth families are required to sign releases giving permission to others involved, including foster parents. Is it not reasonable to give foster parents the same rights? Such as if we go to family unity meetings working together, the birth parents are required to sign a release form to allow us to be there and involved with any information. I would like foster parents to be given that courtesy also. I hear of the value put on foster families, but this is a clear example of the way we would like to receive respect towards our families.
Yes, I'm Linda Terrell from Amity, and I'm a foster parent, adoptive parent. I'm also a Oregon Foster Parent Association Western Region Rep, and I want to say that the board strongly supports this, that I think I come at more concern of the children. I presently have one in care who's going to termination. I have some concerns that if her mother knew where I was, that should she lose termination, she will snatch her. So I guess for me it's much more an issue of safety for the children. I haven't been threatened personally, although I know people who have found out where we lived and driven by and stuff. But my concern is more that the kids are at risk if we have, because of the way the laws are, the children are left in the home much, much longer. And so by the time they come into care, it's generally a really bad situation. And so they need to know that they are safe.
Very much. If you could give Diane copies of your letters, she can make them for the record and get them back to you. Appreciate that. Thank you very much. We're going to close public hearing on Senate Bill 407 and open the work session. That's Sandy Piercy.
I would move Senate Bill 407 to the following consent
recommendation. That's Senator Piercy has made the motion. Is there any discussion? Questions? That's Senator Lehman.
Chairman, this bill is a very good bill. I have a little concern about whether it would go far enough to offer protection in the courtroom, but at least it's a significant step in that direction. And I can't imagine a reasonable judge, and there are some out there, that would order a parent to disclose an address, based on being confidential. So I think it goes far enough that we offer enough protection there. If that doesn't go far enough, then the next session, I'll look at, extending it, and I'll write not to disclose that in court.
Any other discussion? Call the roll.
Representative Winker.
Aye.
Representative Taylor.
Aye.
Representative Piercy.
Aye.
Representative Lehman.
Aye.
Representative Crummel.
Aye.
Representative Snope.
Aye.
Representative Close.
Nay.
Chair Cruz.
Aye. Senate Bill 407, having received the required majority, is declared passed. Somebody like to carry?
I'd
like to carry, yeah. I'm trying to blame on carry. Yeah. Okay. Close the work session on Senate Bill 407 and open, public hearing on Senate Bill 579. Linda? And Luke?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Linda Ludwig, and I'm here representing the League of Oregon Cities. I have with me today Mayor Swaim from the City of Salem, Stacey Graham from the City of Staten, and Ann Glaze from the State Commission on Children and Family. We're here to talk to you about Senate Bill 579.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Mike Swaim. I'm the mayor of the City of Salem. Also have the pleasure of serving on the board of directors of the League of Oregon Cities, as well as the at-risk committee that dealt with juvenile issues during the interim. And I want to also acknowledge and commend Representative Piercy and Representative Lehman. We're both on that at-risk committee. And former mayor now Representative Morissette was on that committee. I don't see Bill here this afternoon, but he certainly was a major player in that. In fact, co-chaired it with Mayor Tory from Eugene. And after Mayor Morissette's ascension to the State House here, I've been kindly asked to take his place as co-chair. This committee, of course, was concerned about not only the ramifications of what occurred in Springfield, Thurston High School, but also the continuing seeming escalation of juveniles in trouble, juveniles disconnected from their communities, juveniles that are at risk. And I think there was a general acknowledgement that all of our children in today's climate are really at risk in one capacity or another. And this at-risk youth committee sought to bring together as many of the stakeholders and interested parties as possible to look at some of these issues. And I think that that point of view and that methodology is what brings the City of Salem and others to the table to urge a vote out of this committee on Senate Bill 579. We certainly acknowledge the fact that the present system with respect to juvenile issues is a pretty strong mosaic with a lot of players that are presently involved in the process of attempting to understand and to act upon these issues to the benefit of not only youth but the communities in which they exist. But there's one piece at least of that mosaic that's missing, and that's the piece that is brought to the table by the cities themselves. As Representative Winters may know, the City of Salem is a participant now what we call the Youth Compact, which puts together representatives of Salem-Kaiser, Marion Polk Commissions, as well as the school district in attempting to address at-risk issues and other related issues dealing with youth. And we found that with as complex as these issues happen to be, it requires the best thoughts of all of us, and sometimes that's not even enough to try and put viable alternatives on the table to be able to measurably improve the circumstances of youth and the health of the community. So what we're here to urge is, as I said, a due pass on 579. I'm pleased to report that the Senate General Government Committee voted unanimously to send the bill to the floor with a due pass recommendation. It passed on the Senate floor 24-2. The only effect of the bill is to add city representatives to the existing combination of interests at the table of children and the Children and Families Commission. So with that, I'd certainly invite any questions that you might have and be pleased to answer.
Questions? Representative Taylor.
Thank you. Mayor Swaim, the bill calls for persons who have knowledge of the issues relating to municipal government. Do you think that a former council person or a retired mayor might be allowed to serve under that?
Yes, Chairman Cruz and Representative Taylor, that's exactly so. It seems at first blush to be a little bit broad, but I think it's an acknowledgement that we want to go where the knowledge, expertise, the energy happens to be. That might be an elected official. That might be a former elected official. It might be someone that is involved in city government as an employee. But the important issue is to bring that municipal perspective as well articulated and advocated as possible to the table from the point of view of the municipalities.
Senator Percy.
Thank you. I just wanted to make a comment. Actually, I came and testified on this on the other side of the building because I, as I've worked here at the legislative level and worked on my local commission, Lane County Commission on Tourism, it's become really important to me how about how these connections are made, because it's important for the people to have to implement these things and live with them, be part of the process. And so I think this is a really good step in the right direction, and I appreciate that.
Any other questions?
Not a question, just a comment. Just thank you for coming and testifying and bringing this forward. And they often hear in our committees the collaboration that it's done in the city of Salem in not only this particular issue, but in other issues in our city that we tend to try to embrace all of our stakeholders to make sure that we're getting input. So this is one where the rest of the state can emulate what we're doing.
This message brought to you courtesy of... Thank you, Representative Winters.
My name is Stacey Graham. I'm the president of the City Council in Staten, and I'm also involved with Friends of the Family, which is a community progress team, which is part of the Marion County Children and Families Commission. In Marion County, we actually have voluntarily two commission members who are city managers or city administrators from both Staten and Silverton. Many of you probably know that when the Children and Families Commission system was first created by the legislature, that one of the four goals was a mandate that there be local planning and decision-making and that local people be involved. And I think the system in our county has done an excellent job of making that happen. But I do think that cities more and more, particularly smaller cities, are becoming involved in issues they've never had before. I know in my community it was land use and roads and infrastructure and law enforcement, and we didn't venture out much into the world of prevention, but the circumstances are such now that we are beginning to do those things. One example of how this process is working in Marion County is youth peer courts. In many counties, youth peer courts are a part of the county juvenile department. In Marion County, they are not. They are, in fact, independent organizations that are coming through the cities and through the community progress teams, and we are all working together. And I think that that kind of collaboration between cities and the county will happen more and more as the role of cities in looking at children and families issues broadens. And I think that, at least from our city administrator's point of view, his world has been broadened greatly since serving on the Children and Families Commission. In fact, he's been on the commission now, I think, for about 5 or 6 months, and he himself has already started a mediation, went out and got the local newspaper to fund a peer-to-peer mediation program that we're going to be introducing in the community this fall. So the benefits, I think, are going to be great. So I'm very much in support of Senate Bill 579.
Questions?
That you will be, too.
Thank you very much.
And we have Ann Blake.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ann Glaze. I'm the manager of policy and planning for the Commission on Children and Families. We're here today to tell you that the State Commission members themselves have not taken a position on this bill, but we would like to point out that the current statute already requires diverse membership of the populations, and certainly municipal government is one of the diverse members that are essential participants in the decisions about how to improve the lot of children and families in the communities of Oregon.
Questions? Senator Winters.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How many of the local commissions on children and families do have the municipal representatives as part of it?
Mr. Chair, Representative Winters, I don't have an exact figure. Some local commissions do have municipal representation. Not all of them do. Would you like me to follow up and get you the answer?
I was just, you know, we have It'd just be nice to know. I know that here in the Valley that we seem to be very much involved, both from city, county governments, and it'd be nice to know if all the other city and county governments were as interested as but this will require them to be a little more interested.
Representative Snow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The language that currently is in law goes to members shall include persons who have knowledge of the issues relating to children and families in affected communities, including education and the court system. And we're adding municipal government. Why wouldn't we add county government or state government or regional government? Is there a reason that the language wasn't this way in the beginning?
Mr. Chair, Representative Knopf, I'm not sure that the discussion occurred in great detail originally in House Bill 2004 about the exact membership. The idea was to make sure that local commissions represented as broad an audience as possible, but I think that the discussion just didn't get to that level of detail. Where we are today, I think that county government, because it's the Board of County Commissioners that makes the appointments, is well represented. The opportunity to add municipal government kind of fills in where in those counties where that's not something that's already done, just naturally occurring through the evolution of the commission.
Looks like we have two other people.
you sparked some interest. In
Apparently so.
Would you like to respond to either of you?
Thanks, Graham. I think that Ann is correct in that we have a fairly broad base of county government and county organizations that are represented either as members, commission members, or as ad hoc or advisory members on almost all the commissions, juvenile directors. Most of the commissions have a county commissioner or a county commissioner designee, and the county commissioners do make the appointments. Having not been around at the time that the original legislation occurred, but having read volumes of information, background information, I don't think that cities were particularly left out. I just don't think that a lot of cities were at that time really looking at all the same kinds of issues that they're looking at now, and I think it's just becoming clearer and clearer that we have to be at the table and we have to be playing an important role. So I think that this is recognizing that role, and I think that, you know, a lot of the impetus from this, as Mayor Swain said, came from the cities themselves. I went to one of the first at-risk youth meetings where we talked a little bit about some of the work that community progress teams were doing, and when we went around the table, there was only one city representative that served on a commission in the state from that meeting, or people that were aware of it. And I think that the cities are now coming forward and saying we want to be officially recognized as a part of this operation and this plan and this process.
Follow up?
Yes.
Well, the commissions, as they're currently constituted, are specifically talk about lay people. And I guess I'm a little bit concerned that we are commissions, you know, we add you guys this time, and next time here comes another government entity that believes that they need to be recognized and be on the commission, or at least have it in statute that they have to be on the commission. And I'm not interested in seeing a children and families local commission that's filled with, quote, government types or professional government people. I truly do want to see lay people. Lay people, as it's described in the statute, are those who don't get a majority of their income dealing with children and youth. So I guess I have a concern about expanding the language to add folks as opposed to having your folks request appointment from the local board. I don't see why they wouldn't appoint someone at your request if you have somebody who you believe is qualified and should be there. I just, that's my concern about expanding this language right now.
Everyone want to take a shot?
Yeah, I'll say one thing. I think that's an extremely legitimate concern. I think one of the reasons that we asked for the language to be as broad based as we could so that a city council could recommend someone who wasn't necessarily a government worker, but maybe, as Mayor
suggested a former mayor, someone in the community who has a passion, who would be a representative, but who would come back to the community, and would have an understanding of city government and community organization, and would be able to go and represent cities and then come back to the community too. So I think that was one of the, your concern was one of the reasons why we expanded the definition, not so that it wasn't simply a city government employee or a city council member or mayor. That may not address your issue, but I think that was one of the reasons why we.
Other questions? Thank you very much. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 579, and I'm going to open a work session. And I want to point out to the committee that in your packet you have a -1 amendment to this, which basically eliminates the last sentence of the bill. And the purpose for this is that in a lot of rural counties, we find that to have interested, qualified people, the pool can be rather thin, and to exclude somebody from having the ability to serve on the commission after two terms might jeopardize the quality of the system. And so this would allow some of the more rural communities the ability to reappoint somebody even after they serve two terms. And so it's permissive language, and this is a request that some of the rural counties that are having, you get out there and you have a few people that do everything, and that's fine, but sometimes the expertise level can drop off rather quickly, and so we would hate to put the process in jeopardy by not being able to have the right people sit on the commission. So that is the purpose of that. Representative Cromwell.
Ready for a motion?
Yes.
Well, with that, I would move the -1 amendments to Senate Bill 579.
Representative Cromwell has made the motion. Is there any questions or discussion? Any objections?
I'm going to note my objection.
Okay. Representative Canopa objects. Any other objections? Noting none, the -1 amendment is adopted. Representative Pierce.
I just want to make a comment before we move to the next thing, and that I hope that this will put people's mind at ease. The statement in here says that we will look for members who have knowledge of issues relating to children and families, including knowledge of education, municipal government, and the court system. It does not say that you have to find people who have a career in those areas. That as commission members are looking for new members, we are looking for people who have some knowledge about those areas, and I hope that will satisfy people more.
That's a good point.
Thank you. Just to speak to including the municipal government, for us in Salem, I can address that. The involvement with the city in planning for youth activities has been a tremendous benefit. We've moved to where we have extreme skate parks. The park by the bridge, and I think to miss that resource or to exclude that resource is not really planning and looking at the total range of needs and services when you get into issues as the police mm-hmm. department and all those others. And I, for one, think that it's a plus to add them to this particular bill. They are a part of what happens in the city. They're part of what happens in our county. And I think they also need to be engaged in the discussion that we talk about services to children's families.
Any other questions? Representative Cromwell.
I move Senate Bill 579 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Cromwell has made the motion. Is there any discussion? Questions? Clerk, call the roll.
Representative Winter.
Aye.
Representative Taylor.
Aye.
Representative Piercy.
Aye.
Representative Morissette.
Aye.
Representative Lehman.
Yes.
I was in the way.
Representative Cromwell.
Aye.
Representative Snow.
No.
Representative
Nay.
Chair Cruz.
Aye. Senate Bill 579, having received the required majority, is declared passed. Representative Piercy, would you like to carry?
Sure would.
Representative Piercy will carry, and I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 579. And I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 314.
Sure. Senate Bill 314 changes the name of the Public Welfare Review Commission to the Adult and Family Services Division Review Commission and changes the length of the term members from 2 to 4 years.
Okay. Jim Neely. This is another massively controversial bill, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jim Neely, Deputy Administrator of the Adult and Family Services Division, and I'm here to testify in support of this short but I think important bill. The commission has requested that their name change to reflect not only the change in the name of the division, which changed in 1977 from the Public Welfare Division to the Adult and Family Services Division, but also to reflect the change in the work of the division and the review commission to reflect that it's really no longer just an income maintenance effort, but rather an effort at self-sufficiency and improving the financial status of our families.
Any questions? Representative Morissette.
Yes. My assistant wanted me to ask you the fiscal impact of going from 4 to 7 words, is that...
Mr. Chair, Representative Morissette...
Growth in government.
I think the impact will be minimal, and we can probably absorb that within our current budget.
Okay, I'll pass that along. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you very much.
You.
I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 314, work session.
Chair.
Representative Piercy.
I would move Senate Bill 314 for the new pass recommendation.
Representative Piercy has made the motion. Is there any questions or discussion? Hearing none, will clerk call the roll.
Representative 314
having received the required majority is declared passed. Representative Morissette, would you like to?
Oh, I'd like to.
You asked the question.
I'll probably be asked that on the floor. I'm sure I will.
Now we know what we don't do.
I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 314. Got to find some little hook.
That's right. Okay,
I'm going to open the public hearing on Senate Bill 322.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 322 creates a limited license to practice registered or practical nursing for certain foreign nurses and foreign student nurses. It eliminates the 30-day grace period for renewal of certain nursing licenses, and it eliminates the CCAP for a nursing assistant certificate.
Welcome.
Chair Cruz and members of the committee, my name is Lee Shores, and I'm a patient consulting staff physician for the Board of Nursing. I'm here to introduce the concepts that are proposed in Senate Bill 322A in growth, and to respond to any questions the committee might have. Senate Bill 322 does three things. It amends the Nurse Practice Act to add a limited license for international nurses, international students, and nurses' licenses in other jurisdictions for the purpose of coming to Oregon for educational experience. This amendment was proposed by the Board of Nursing in response to requests that we had from the community, specifically from several schools of nursing who are attempting to respond to issues in this regard.
second measure eliminates the existing 30-day grace period, and I'll speak to that in a little more detail in a moment, and increases the fee cap for CNAs from $20 to $40. The first provision, the limited license for international nurses, simply extends the opportunity for the Board of Nursing to set the requirements that would provide for public safety without placing undue burden on both the students themselves and on the schools that are attempting to respond to their educational needs. There are two persons who are here to testify to that, Juliana Cartwright, who is Associate Dean of the Oregon Health Sciences University, Southern, and I'll ask Julia to speak to that measure.
Thank you. Chairman Cruz and members of the Human Resources Committee, I am Juliana Cartwright, Associate Dean for the Oregon Health Sciences University School of Nursing in Ashland. I'm speaking today in support of Senate Bill 322, specifically the amendment adding an additional category of limited licensure for international nursing students seeking limited educational experiences in Oregon. The School of Nursing supports this amendment because we believe it will facilitate our ability to participate in cross-cultural student exchanges. Currently, the School of Nursing is a partner in the North American Mobility Project. This is a federally funded program of 6 university schools of nursing, 2 in Canada, 2 in Mexico, and 2 in the United States. Our full participation in this project requires that we host visiting nursing students as well as send our own students to Mexico and Canada. Even though we have developed mechanisms to tightly screen and monitor visiting students from our partner universities, Oregon statute currently prevents foreign students from participating in our program. The proposed amendment will allow us to offer supervised learning experiences to guest students. The wording of this amendment protects residents of our state by requiring that our nursing schools accept and supervise only guest students meeting our program standards. Oregon Schools of Nursing will review the qualifications of guest applicants, and we will supervise the guest students using the same criteria to ensure safe practice that we supervise our students. We appreciate your consideration of this amendment.
Members of the committee, I'm Joe Bell. I'm with the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems, and I just wanted to say on behalf of the nurse executives and hospitals, we currently work with the schools of nursing to provide placements for students, and we think that it would be appropriate to extend the same courtesy to foreign students, and we'd be more than happy to have them in our facilities as well.
Any questions?
The second measure is for elimination of the 30-day grace period. The 30-day grace period for licenses was put in place at a time when the board issued all licenses on the same date, and there were times when it was possible administratively to accomplish that in time for every practitioner. So it was necessary for them to have a temporary license in order to cover that administrative problem. For a long period of time, that has not been the case, and in fact, the grace period has created confusion where employers don't recognize a grace period, and yet the Board of Nursing allows it. So we are asking that provision be eliminated from statute in order to be clear that the nurse is eligible to practice only with a current valid license.
Question. Thank you.
And my colleague, Pat Miles, mm-hmm. will introduce the third time.
Chair Cruz, members of the committee, I'm Pat Miles. I'm the business manager for the Board of Nursing. The third element of this bill raises a $20 cap that was set in 1989 on CNA fees before the board began regulating the certified nursing assistant. We had no history of actual costs. We had no prediction of how many people would be regulated or the complexity to which this program would grow. Currently, we regulate approximately 17,000 actively certified nursing assistants. We administer 250 written and clinical examinations per month. We approve 110 nursing assistant programs throughout the state, conduct law enforcement data system checks on every application, and investigate at least 600 complaints and positive lead checks per biennium. This program is funded currently through a federal matching program using Medicare and Medicaid dollars. We receive a block grant of $235,000, but all the rest of the funds must be matched 50-50 by the board. This fee cap affects our renewal fee, the fee for endorsing in from another state, and the certification fee, straight certification that we allow for student nurses, RNs, and LPNs. These account for 70% of our application volume, but they only brought in 25% of the actual funding to the program during this last biennium. 25% more was added through SDSD federal matching funds. Excluding specific costs for testing and small variations in application processing, we believe that all CNAs should pay an equal share of the program costs. Failure to raise the cap would result in 30% of the population, which is the testing applicants, subsidizing the remaining 70%. When we began work on this bill, we requested a total removal of the cap because all of our other fees are set in administrative procedure. In working with long-term care industry and the members of the Senate committee, we got consensus to simply raise the cap to $40. And we believe that even though we don't like raising fees, this will allow us to at least cover the cost of the CNA program. Thank you.
Questions? Thank you very much. Senator Cromwell.
I'm sorry. The fee the cap is a doubling. Do you anticipate going immediately to the cap?
Chair. Ruth, Representative Kummel, we have predicted in our budget that we would raise the CNA renewal fee to $35, and the endorsement and straight certification fees, which are a one-time cost, to $38. This is primarily because we did a fee study and we realized that that's how much it costs. Twice that amount is what it costs to run the program.
Follow up. Is that a that's a cut? Oh, that's $40 per biennium.
That is
correct. Is what? So, if a person gets a CNA certificate, they've it's good for 2 years.
That is correct.
And then, what do they do to renew that?
Chairman Cruz, Representative Kummel, when they wish to renew, well, their certificate expires on their birth date every alternate year. We send them an application, which they fill out. They represent to us that they have been practicing the required number of hours under the proper supervision and answer certain questions regarding, an example would be criminal history, that sort of thing. Then we process that, investigate any, for example, positive LEDs check, and renew their license for another 2 years.
Okay.
Other questions? Thank you very much.
Before we close the public hearing, Mr. Chair, I do have one other question with regards to the foreign nurses.
Okay.
If I may. And that is, how are we defining foreign nurse? Is that defined as outside of the United States? Because I didn't see it in here when I read the bill. And is that outside the United States or outside of Oregon? And I think that there's a...
The bill would provide for three categories of individuals to be regulated by rule developed by the board. One of them would be a nurse who is educated and licensed in another country. The second would be nursing students in a school of nursing in another country, outside the United States. And the third category is a nurse who is licensed in another state in this country and is seeking educational experience in Oregon. That final provision was added in an amendment in the Senate at the request of the University of Portland through exploration of telecourse provisions for nurses in other states who would, under current law, be required to hold an Oregon license in order to sit by video monitor in an Oregon classroom.
So we're seeking the flexibility of being able to develop rules that allow those students to take advantage of Oregon educational experience without the requirement, which is fairly onerous in some cases, of requiring an Oregon license.
Thank you.
Representative, that would be page 2, lines 30 through 34 of the bill.
I understand, Mr. Chair, but a nurse license in another jurisdiction, I mean, that could be another state, another country. A foreign nurse could be foreign to Oregon or foreign to the United States, and that's why I just wanted to have it clarified on the record. So it would be,
I agree that the language is somewhat ambiguous, and it became that way through the process of having one initial concept and then doing the change by amendment. The intention was that the first concept, foreign nurse, was a nurse in another country, and the intention was that the nurse in another jurisdiction is another state in this country, and the terms are confusing.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you very much. And close the public hearing on Senate Bill 322 at the work session. Representative Pusey.
I would move Senate Bill 322 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and subsequent referral to Ways and Means be rescinded.
Representative Pusey has made the motion. Any discussion or questions?
This was going to go to Ways and Means because of the $40? Well, times 17,000 is a whole bunch. But.
Front-end decisions on what goes to Ways and Means or not are made in a somewhat speculative fashion. As it turns out, if you look on the fiscal analysis sheet, it's got a fiscal impact of $3,000, which is certainly below the $50,000 limit. It's got a revenue impact of $250,000. However, that is other funds. This was included in the governor's budget, and it is already in the budget, and that budget has already moved. So if we sent it there to meet up with its budget, it would be a loan. So,
well, let's not let it be a loan.
So what are we doing
there? We are moving it to the floor. Any other questions?
I would just make one other comment, Mr. Chair. I am concerned about raising the cap from 20 to 40, understanding that it is only a cap that we're raising. But the testimony was that they're going to go immediately to a $35 and a $38 charge. For a person that's a CNA, I think that is a hit. Understandably, it's only $40 over a two-year period, which, if we look at it on a monthly basis, is definitely much more than a buck and a half or something. But I think that it is something that I would like to make sure that the department makes their people aware of.
Okay. Yeah, I'd like to join the Representative Kremel. I've had enough of fees club. I would suggest that we not hear from them for a very long time.
Representative Cano, probably not, at least not until the year 2001, I would think.
Yeah.
When was the last time you had a fee increase? 1989.
You'll
be long gone.
Okay. Well, just don't come back until he's turned out.
Oh, Lord.
I think there is some concern, because what happens is that, and it probably should be reviewed on a biennial basis as far as what the fees are doing. And the reason I say that is because we've got these fees, and then all of a sudden, you know, like they haven't been raised in 10 years or 20 years or 48 years or whatever, and then all of a sudden we're expected to be approving these big, huge jumps in these fees. And I think that's something to be a little bit concerned about. And I would prefer not to be in a situation where we're approving fees with huge jumps. And with that, I'll shut up, Mr. Chair.
Representative Cromwell, and I certainly understand that, but I think anybody's getting rich off this fee. I think they're paying for the services they're rendering. And with that, will the clerk call the roll?
Director Cromwell?
Representative Winters?
Aye.
Representative Pierce?
Aye.
Representative Morissette?
Aye.
Representative Hummel?
Aye.
Representative Hill?
Aye.
Representative Cook?
Aye.
Pierce?
Aye. Senate Bill 322, having received the required majority, is declared passed. Who would like to carry? Representative
Chair, just before you make this recommendation, can you get up on the floor and say this is a really bad bill? I don't think you should vote for it, even though you're the carrier.
It has happened.
Has it happened?
No. Representative Crummel will carry.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I close the work session on Senate Bill 322 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 565. Damn it.
Senate Bill 565 allows community college districts and community college service districts to enter into contracts or operate self-insurance programs to provide employees, students, and others with health benefits.
Okay. Camera?
If you don't mind, Mr. Chair, I'd like to invite Rhonda Rhodes with me. For the record, my name is Tamara Dykeman, represent Oregon Community College Association. With me is Rhonda Webster-Palos, and she's the Benefit and Compensation Manager for Portland Community College. Senate Bill 565 simply adds community colleges to the list of local governments that are allowed to self-insure for health insurance purposes. Currently, counties, cities, special districts, and school districts have this authority, so basically all local governments except for community colleges have this at this point. This bill does not alter any of the requirements currently associated with self-insurance. Community colleges would have to have 1,000 corporate employees and meet all the other requirements of the statute. And this bill passed the Senate unanimously, 26-0 vote. And we would be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are you planning on saving money by the
If it's certainly an option, and that's one of the reasons we would like to take a look to see if it's in the best interest of Portland Community College to become self-insured. One opportunity could be a cost savings. Another opportunity is to design our benefits so that they're more tailor fit to our employee population. Self-insurance is the only vehicle to do either one of those.
Would you identify yourself for the record, please?
My name is Rhonda. I'm from Portland Community College.
You have a last name?
Webster Taylor.
Thank you. We just need that for the record. Any other questions?
Should you have realized savings, what do you plan to do with those savings?
There are a number of options that employers use with cost savings that potentially could be realized. One option would be to turn those savings back to the employees in the form of reduced premiums. Another option would be to enhance benefits to that group of employees. And yet another opportunity would be to bring that money back into the college to fund other general fund opportunities.
Mm-hmm. Representative Crummel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can the schools aggregate under this statute?
Mr. Chair, Representative Crummel, they could, but I've talked with some of them, and it would be very difficult for them to do that. They have different collective bargaining agreements. They have different systems at this point. But it is something they could take advantage of in the future.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Thank you.
Thank you. Good. I close the public hearing on Senate Bill 565 for the work session.
I'm glad.
Representative Winters.
I move Senate Bill 565 to the floor
with the Senate Winters has made the motion. Any discussion? Questions? Clerk, call the roll.
Representative Winters.
Aye.
Representative Taylor.
Aye.
Representative Kirby.
Aye.
Aye.
Representative Crummell.
Aye.
Representative Miller.
Aye.
Representative Close.
Aye.
Chair Cruz.
Aye. Senate Bill 565 has received the required majority of the pass. Representative Winters, would you like to carry?
Okay.
Closed work session on Senate Bill 565, and I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 600.
Senate Bill 600 creates a license for practice of medicine across state lines. It directs the Board of Medical Examiners to issue licenses to physicians located outside of Oregon who render medical treatment or opinions to persons within the state by electronic communication. This is a measure that passed the Senate 28-0 nays, two excuse for unlegislative business. You'll also see with your packet that there are two sets of amendments. There are the dash three amendments, and these were proposed, I believe, by the, these ones by the Oregon Medical Association. Bruce Bishop on behalf of Kaiser when reviewed jointly with the Board of Medical Examiners on behalf of Board of Medical Examiners and the OMA. And then there is a dash four amendment, and these were proposed. Peggy Arnett. Okay, by whom? Oregon Nursing. Oh, the OMA. Okay, I'm sorry. Oregon Medical Association. It's an OMA.
They're probably dissimilar organizations, I think.
Right, they are. And that's all.
Okay.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair. Clarification, dash fours are proposed by the OMA?
And dash three.
Dash threes are the OMA, because that's the letter that goes along with them. Is that right?
No.
Mr. Chair, my name is Mike Frew. I'm the attorney counsel of the Oregon Medical Association. If I could, just to clarify, the association is not proposing any amendments to the dash A, SB 600 A engrossed. We think the bill's fine the way it came out of the Senate. The letter of the OMA dated May 11, 1999 is in response to the amendments that have been proposed by Mr. Bishop on behalf of Kaiser. If the OMA would rather see the bill move out of committee as it is written, as it came over from the Senate.
Okay. Go ahead.
I'll just finish by saying that if the committee is going to consider the amendments that are proposed by Mr. Bishop on behalf of Kaiser, then our response is set forth in our letter of May 11th as to what we would hope the committee might consider. And that's really all I had to say about the bill. Dr. Hicks is here from the OMA, and I think he can expand on the purpose, excuse me, the BME, and can expand on the purpose.
Tom, too many letters.
OMA, BME.
Under Cruz, members of the committee, my name is James Hicks. I'm the medical director of the Oregon Board of Medical Examiners. We appreciate the chance to carry this bill from the other side and give you the opportunity to protect the citizens of Oregon. Senate Bill 600 represents an addition to the licensing structure of the BME, which will give us the authority to regulate other practices which come from outside of the state. Current Oregon law only allows a physician to have an active license if he or she resides within 100 miles of the border. Otherwise, the license, except in cases of a particular, what's called a locum tenens license, is designated as inactive and only is activated when that physician moves into the state, at which time a careful background check is made on anything that has occurred in that physician's history subsequent to his or her application to come into the state. The current system does not provide a means for a legitimate telemedicine physician to practice on the citizens of Oregon located outside of the state. It's kind of a catch-22. This bill would solve that catch-22 and allow us to license physicians who do not reside in the state of Oregon who are practicing medicine on citizens of the state of Oregon. And the definition of the BME, as is the definition of most states, is that medicine is practiced where the patient is, not where the physician is. So if a physician is practicing by whatever electronic means, typically electronic means, on a citizen of the state of Oregon, then the medicine is practiced in the state, according to our definition. There are additional benefits to SB 600. Recently, it's been very obvious that physicians of questionable integrity have been advertising and dispensing medications over the Internet without any effort to see or examine a patient, which the BME considers a clear breach of the practice of medicine. Under SB 600, these practitioners would be required to obtain an Oregon telemedicine license prior to doing this. SB 600 would also dissuade these practitioners from soliciting business in Oregon, and should they solicit and engage in activities that the BME would consider outside of the standard of care, we have grounds to either directly approach them or, more forcefully, we have grounds to report their activities to the state of their residence. And when we can act, even in default, or if a physician in another state chooses not to come to an invited hearing in this state, we can act in a default manner, and once that report is made to another state, they normally act in consequence. The board is of one mind with the Oregon Medical Association and a telemedicine task force that's operated over the last several months in creating this legislation, and we recommend a due pass of SB 600 as it came from the Senate.
Dr. Hicks, have you seen the Dash-3 amendment?
Representative Cruz, I have, and I speak with one mind with Mr. Crew, in that if they are, if you want to consider those, we would like you to consider them in light of his response to the letter of May 11th. There are some of those that we find acceptable that may, in essence, gild the lily a little bit, but in general, we would prefer it as it came out of the Senate.
Okay. Also, just to put it up the record, I misspoke. The Dash 4s are from Regents Blue Cross. I got confused. I don't know how that could have happened on a day like today. But Dr. Hicks, Dash 4 says Section 2 to 6 of this 1999 Act do not apply to a physician employed or retained by an insurer, health insurer, health care service contractor, or health maintenance organization to review medical records and render opinions as to whether particular products, services, or courses of treatment are compensable. And I would like for you and for Mr. Crew to respond and tell me if this is a necessary amendment, or is this already being taken care of with the bill?
Representative Cruz, it would be the feeling of the BME, and I think the OMA, that this is not necessary because it does not, in our eyes, constitute the practice of medicine. It is not patient care, and we are attempting to regulate patient care here. The rendering of consultations in or outbound from the state, from physicians to others, either other physicians or other administrators, as expert testimony or review, the board does not regulate at this point. That may be some consideration that in other places, expert witness testimony or certain administrative functions of physicians have been interpreted to be the practice of medicine. The board has not done that and does not consider this the practice of medicine, and so we don't feel like it needs to be included in this bill.
Any other questions?
Mr. Chair, if sure. I could, just on that issue, I've been corresponding with the OMA on that proposed amendment. Section 2, subparagraph 1, says that this bill involves the rendering directly to a person. It is specifically intended to only affect where a out-of-state physician is rendering directly to a resident of this state medical care.
proposed amendment has to do with a relationship between an insurer or a health plan with an out-of-state physician. This bill doesn't reach that relationship. It was never intended to.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd just like to have clarified, for the benefit of the district that I represent in the northwest corner of the state, right where the Columbia River residents flow back and forth across the bridge, and some people from Clatsop County go up to Washington for health care, and they often come down to Oregon. I wondered about the suggestion of Kaiser regarding physicians located outside the state. If in your view, Senate Bill 600A, without the amendment, does nothing to change that present relationship, whatever it is. I'm not altogether clear on who has to be licensed for what. I'm not an expert on that.
I think the certainly it doesn't hurt it to change it to physicians licensed outside the state. The intent of the board is only to affect those physicians practicing outside the state who are establishing a non-patient, non-face-to-face relationship with the patient via electronic means or other means.
Representative Crummel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Dr. Hicks, if I understand correctly, and please correct me if I'm wrong, if I had something, and I'm consulting with a doctor at Northwestern University in Chicago, and I'm here and he's there, and so he says, well, gee, what you have is whatever problem, and take this kind of medication, and under this license, can he write me a prescription that I can take to my, or can he fax me a prescription that I can take to my pharmacy and have it filled because he's licensed under this statute?
President Cruz, Representative Crummel. Yes, sir. That prescribing, there is some confusion regarding prescribing and dispensing. If you would allow me, I'll clarify that. Prescribing is simply, as you know it, that's the writing of a prescription.
Yes.
It is done by a practitioner, typically a physician or a nurse practitioner or a physician assistant who has designated prescribing authority. Dispensing is, for practical purposes, the acting of one of those practitioners as a pharmacist for profit, i.e., maintaining a stock of drugs in your office, prescribing, and then handing out those drugs to be used outside of your office for compensation. And that's what we wish to prohibit by prohibiting a dispensing physician from being a telemedicine provider. That would have specific effect on internet prescribers who now prescribe and dispense over the internet. However, a legitimate practitioner who has a telemedicine license for Oregon and who you have consulted and who considers that the interaction that they have made with you to be within standard, have they have gained enough clinical information about you that that would be standard of care, whether it's done by television or done by whatever means, but they met the standard of care for properly diagnosing you and wish to prescribe for you, they could send you a prescription, and that prescription would be legitimately done and might be legitimately filled.
Let me take it one step further. For some reason, I decided I want to go to San Francisco for some kind of care. It's more than 100 miles away, and I understand the current statute is 100-mile limitation. I go down to San Francisco, get a prescription, bring it back to Oregon. Can I get that prescription filled?
That's not even covered by this bill. That's not telemedicine, because you've seen that prescription there. That really does not fall under the Board of Medical Examiners, because that care was rendered to you by a California physician. It is my understanding that the Board of Pharmacy allows out-of-state prescriptions to be filled so long as the pharmacist can ascertain that the prescription is issued by a valid practitioner in the state in which it was done. But that really doesn't fall under the jurisdiction of the BME at that point.
Okay, so if I may follow up. So with regards to out-of-state care, then it is dependent on where the patient is. So as long as I'm in Oregon, but I'm being treated by a physician out of state, then it would fall under this telemedicine statute.
That's correct, sir.
I thought I heard you say that there was a question about face-to-face types of care, and it isn't a normal standard of care to be, I have a problem, I see you, feel around, touch it, and wiggle it, and whatever, and then say, okay, this is what your problem is, and then prescribe some kind of treatment, whatever that treatment may be, and maybe you actually render a treatment. Doesn't this sort of fly in the face of that?
Representative Cruz, Representative Crummell, it would if we did not evolve in our thinking. Our feeling, however, is that with modern communications, particularly with television, with interactive video, that, let's say, a dermatologist, this is already taken within state. I mean, this diagnosis, there are interactions made within the state of which we don't have to worry about because we already have those people are actively licensed Oregon physicians, don't fall under this. But let's say a dermatologist in Idaho were to treat via television, look at a skin lesion via television of an Oregon patient. That dermatologist who at that point could reasonably say that I've conducted a sufficient examination with perhaps the assistance of someone there describing any swelling, any tumor, any redness, but as long as a bona fide attempt is made to fully diagnose the patient by whatever means are at hand, be they electronic, be they the transmission of sufficient clinical material, and that's where the standard of the board comes in. If the Board of Medical Examiners feels that that sufficient bona fide effort at diagnosis and treatment is being made, a situation might exist that a pediatrician will at night make a diagnosis over the telephone, choose to see the patient the next day, or maybe not, and that's been a standard for a long time. It's up to the physician to determine how much examination needs to be carried on, and this just allows that within the confines of good medical care, a radiologist will frequently not even see a patient and make a diagnosis based on an X-ray. Now, they may not prescribe over that, but they would certainly diagnose. Whether or not they prescribe is really immaterial. But they would diagnose, and other practitioners may, or that patient may, get treatment for him or herself based on that diagnosis. It is the direct diagnosis or treatment of a patient from a physician located outside the state to a patient located in the state that this act is designed to address. Whether or not it involves the writing of a prescription or not, it's the diagnosis and treatment that we're attempting to, that we want to control. And we are being asked all the time, I'm a radiologist, I'm a whatever, I'm a consultant, and I want to directly interact with patients. And there are certainly some situations, I mean, you can't truly and easily diagnose somebody over a cold, a urinary tract infection or what over the telephone or over television. On the other hand, lives have been saved by telemedicine of people who've been diagnosed on a boat in the South Pacific or in the middle of China. So it's just that the board wants to respond to the fact that the practice of medicine is changing and allow appropriate practice of medicine by electronic means. It's not changing the standard by any sense. It's just allowing, in those cases where sufficient information can be exchanged between patient and physician, that will become a legitimate practice of medicine rather than one that's in a gray area.
Just sort of there. One more follow-up, if I may, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Dr. Hicks. One of the things that I think has been frustrating for providers and to a certain degree the patients as well, and that's with regards to some of the insurance carriers. And of course, you know, you get the form letter that says, you know, our medical director has determined that, you know, then whatever the case may be, either, you know, yes, we're going to allow you to have the care, or no, we don't think it's medically necessary, or, you know, whatever in between there is. Does this, and a lot of times, you know, the medical director, the best they've seen is a chart note, and you know that they haven't seen the patient. Is this something that is going to, will Senate Bill 600, I guess, sort of add into that same type of, I don't know if I want to call it problem treating, but will it add into that same type of situation where we end up with providers and even patients to a certain extent in, you know, they're getting frustrated because they're getting advice from a physician, from a practitioner that's never seen the patient but only going on however the information has been transmitted.
Representative Cruz, Representative Crummell. The bill specifically excludes any interaction from physician to physician within the state. If there is an Oregon licensed physician caring for the patient, that physician may obtain consultation from another physician, a PhD, Sidney Omar's astrological table if he wants, but that physician becomes the primary gate for information to the patient. And as long as the board has licensing control and disciplinary control over an Oregon licensed physician who is directly interacting with the patient, then any sources of information that physician goes to, be it a company, an insurance company, whoever, is filtered by one of our licensees. And the board and a paragraph in this act specifically excludes that interaction from requiring a telemedicine license. Only where there is direct electronic patient contact and direct diagnosis and treatment. Now, under the hypothetical situation, it is conceivable that a medical director could be making a decision on a patient without the interaction of the Oregon physician. And in that case, he or she would be responsible to become a telemedicine licensed physician and therefore become responsible to our board for the care rendered that patient, if he or she chose to. Typically, though, those decisions come from a medical director to a primary care or a specialty care physician who is managing that patient. And that patient and that physician who is in the state is our licensee, and therefore the decisions, adverse or favorable, made by that physician or the patient are subject to the review of our board. We want somebody in the chain of care to be subject to the review of the Oregon board when Oregon citizens are being taken care of. And if that is an Oregon physician, then we don't care. We care outside, but we're assuming that physician will be responsible for the quality of the information. It's only when the direct patient care does not involve another licensee that this bill comes into play.
Thank you. Senator Winters.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Hicks, you commented that the Bash, I'm going to get back to the two amendments, that the Bash 4 amendments was not necessary, but you did comment on the Bash 3. Would you comment for me on what is your opinion on the necessity or the non-necessity of the Bash 3 and why?
Representative Cruz, Representative Winters, I would like to defer to Mr. Crew for that because he has been far more involved, if I might, and then I'll be happy to add to his response.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Winters, we've looked at the amendments, and I have to say that there are several that help clarify some of the language in the bill, but overall it doesn't make a great substantive difference whether or not they're adopted or not adopted. There were several that were proposed in the Dash 3s that we being the OMA, and I believe the DME, object to. For example, the dispensing issue. This bill, the proposed amendments would do away with portion of Section 5 at line 45 of the bill which would not allow a telemedicine physician to act as a dispensing physician. I believe Judge Hicks, or the BME, and through Dr. Hicks, shares that opinion. It also would do away at the top of page 3, lines 1 and 2, with the treatment of intractable pain by an out-of-state physician. And again, the OMA objects to that and would oppose it, and I believe that the BME equally opposes that. And there's sound reason for that. When you're treating intractable pain, generally speaking, the standard is that you have close, direct contact with the patient on a frequent basis, and it seems a little bit to the contrary if you have a physician that's located at some distant point, that they would have that kind of contact. But by and large, we feel that the A. and Gross version of the Senate bill that was passed in the Senate, in fact, does what we would hope it would do, and there was a lot of work that went into that bill, I might add. And we felt that it was a good bill coming out. We don't think any amendments necessary.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Representative Morsop. Were these amendments of language similar to them considered on the Senate side?
Mr. Chair, Representative Morsop, every interested party, including Kaiser, was given the opportunity on the Senate side to submit their proposed changes. And this is, we thought that we had everybody's input on the Senate side before the bill went out of committee to the floor. I don't know why these amendments are coming now.
Okay. Any other questions? Senator Cromwell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one question to Mr. Crewe about the intractable pain. Wouldn't you agree that more of the problem with intractable pain is the fear that the patient will become hooked on whatever it is that they're being prescribed for pain control?
So, Mr. Chair, Representative Crummell, I should defer to Dr. Hicks because he's the one that spoke to this on the Senate side, but certainly the treatment of intractable pain does involve presumably prescribing a significant amount of narcotics for an extended period of time, and I believe that is the concern, but Dr. Hicks could certainly speak to that better than I.
Mr. Chair, Representative Crummell, I would agree with Mr. Crewe that the primary concern is simply appropriate use of controlled substances. The DEA has set forth the controlled substances in a series of schedules, and prior to the passing of the Intractable Pain Act two legislatures ago, we did not have guidelines for physicians wishing to treat them, and there were a number of times that the board disciplined physicians for offenses that the physicians subsequently felt were between a rock and a hard place. So we have attempted to give physicians in the Intractable Pain Law, or 677-470 through 485, some safe harbors for the treatment of that. And there's actually a bill that came out of the last Legislative Assembly's Pain and Symptom Task Force designed to tune up the 677-470, and the BME has had input to that bill, and I think it's coming across. That's 582? I think it's 582, but it involves some changes to the Intractable Pain Law that clarify it and give further safe harbor to physicians and open up that in response to the output of that task force.
Thank you. Thanks.
Any other questions? Thank you very much. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 600. Public session.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Taylor.
I move Senate Bill 600A to the floor with the pass recommendation.
Representative Taylor has made the motion. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, will the clerk call the roll.
Representative
Winker.
Aye. Representative Taylor.
Aye.
Representative Morissette.
Aye.
Representative Freeman.
Aye.
Representative Crummell.
Aye.
Aye. Senate Bill 600, having received a required majority of support, passed. Who would like to carry?
I'll carry it if you'd like me to, Mr. Chair.
Representative Cromwell will carry. I'll close the election.
No. Jack, don't be volunteering me.
Good idea.
Close the work session, close committee.